Sects far from settled. Among those who were orthodox in their adherence to the Nicene Creed, a new division arose, given that Christ was God and also man. Just how did these two natures relate to each other? There were two schools of thought. The first held that the two natures had become mystically one, united in the person of Christ in a way impossible to tease out by reason. The second, a more rational school, held that two separate natures, divine and human, were both present but separate, like two different colours of marbles in a jar. The assertion of a single nature became known as monophysitism, while the argument that Christ had two natures mixed together became known as Nestorianism, after Nestorius, Bishop of Constantinople and its most ardent supporter. Author's note, the positions were also defined by the way in which they refer to Mary. If, in Jesus, God and man were mystically one, Mary was Theotokos, the mother of God. If the divine and human natures were mixed together, she was instead Christotokos, the mother of Christ. Theodosius II himself was a Nestorian, but when the Council of Ephesus met to hash out the issue, it finally rejected Nestorianism and condemned Nestorius as a heretic. Theodosius II was forced to bow to pressure and exile Nestorius to an Egyptian monastery. This was a defeat for him, and he felt it. The argument was not just theological hair-splitting. For one thing, there were always political dimensions to the theological debates. This particular controversy was partly about the power centers of the empire. The two natures mixed school of theology was centered in the city of Antioch, while the more mystical one-nature school was centered in Alexandria. The influence and importance of these two cities were at stake. So was the relative power of ambitious men. Cyril, the Bishop of Alexandria, was a one-nature man, as was the Bishop of Rome, while the Bishop of Constantinople, Nestorius, was a two-nature man. Nestorius's condemnation made clear that the Bishop of Rome still sat at the top of the ecclesiastical heap. Fear of Persian influence sharpened the argument further. Zoroastrianism, the religion of the Persians, was a monotheistic religion like Christianity. Nevertheless, it was the religion of the enemy, and the Christians of Rome and Alexandria were suspicious of any Christian doctrines that sounded a little too Zoroastrian. Since Zoroastrianism denied that there could ever be any mixing of divine and earthly substances, Nestorius's two-nature theology fit into the Persian schema in a way that the mystical one-nature theology never could. This tainted it further. In the eyes of the bishops farther from the border, they suspected that Nestorius had been influenced by Persian philosophies. But the theological debates over the nature of Christ's divinity cannot be reduced to politics or nationalism. They were the flashpoint of a bigger war, the symbol that two entirely different ways of thinking were about to come into full conflict. The arguments over Christology were, in fact, not unlike the modern American debates about creationism. A whole complex of ideas is at stake in the defense of a literal creation, a worldview that has some room in it for the supernatural and inexplicable. The fear that conceding this point will lead to the destruction of a moral code, resentment over the superiority and condescension of what are seen as overeducated intellectuals. On the other side, the sharp rejection of all creationist assertions. One thinks of the rhetorical excesses of a Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris, also reveals fears that accepting a mystical explanation of the earth's beginning will lead to the triumph of irrationality and violence, that concession will boost the earthly power of a particular political group. And so it was in the 5th century as well. The men who quarreled over Christology in Alexandria and Rome and Constantinople were also fighting over the place of mysticism and the power of rationalism, the fear of Persian influence and the rejection of all Persian culture, as well as the suspicion that one half of the empire might manage to gain political and practical power over another. Chapter 13. Seeking a Homeland. Between 410 and 418, the Visigoths settle in southwestern Gaul. With Rome behind them, Alaric and his Visigoth army headed south to attack Africa, taking their loot and their captives with them. It was a short journey. Jordanes tells us that a sudden fierce storm wrecked the ships as they sailed from Sicily, forcing the Visigoths to retreat back into southern Italy. Alaric was deciding on his next course of action when he was struck by illness and suddenly died. His men diverted the path of the nearby river Bucentus and led a band of captives into the midst of its bed to dig out a place for his grave. In the depths of this pit they buried Alaric, together with many treasures, and then turned the waters back into their channel, and that none might ever know the place, they put to death all the diggers. The first king of the Visigoths had never gained the recognition he spent most of his life seeking, but at least he received a hero's burial. The Visigoth Atulf became king in his place. Not long after Alaric's death, Atulf married Placida in a formal ceremony in a small city in northern Italy. The Visigoths had apparently given up their plan of crossing over to North Africa. He was, said Jordanes, attracted by her nobility, beauty, and chaste purity. Whether this was a romance of captor and captive, or a political move, the result was the same. The empire and the Goths, Jordanes concludes, now seemed to be made one. Alaric's lifetime of fighting had failed either to overcome that persistent Roman identity, or to merge his own with it. Atulf's marriage, blending Visigoth blood with Roman, accomplished much more in a single stroke. Once married, Atulf decided that Gaul would provide easier pickings than either southern Italy or North Africa. Gaul was in turmoil. It had been in the hands of the British pretender Constantine III, and while Atulf was getting married in North Italy, the Western Emperor Honorius was sending an army over the Alps to get Gaul back. The reconquest succeeded almost at once. Constantine III's soldiers, once in Gaul, had begun to desert him in favor of life in the countryside. His weakened troops fled in the face of the Roman soldiers, and Constantine III ran to the nearest church and had himself ordained as a priest. This blatant attempt to shield himself with the cross was only temporarily successful. Alaric had refused to burn the churches of Rome, and Honorius, the non-barbarian, could do no less. He spared Constantine III's life and instead took him prisoner. While he was being brought back to Rome, however, an assassin murdered him, and his accomplices were, as Jordanes puts it, unexpectedly slain. The supposed unity between fellow Christians was not strong enough to save the life of a challenger to the imperial throne. Atulf's Visigoths inserted themselves into the middle of Gaul, while Honorius was busy with Constantine III. By 413, they had conquered land in the old Roman territory of Narbonensis in southern Gaul, and Atulf had made the city of Toulouse into the capital of a small Visigothic kingdom. He had finally found a possible homeland for Alaric's nation. But rather than establishing his kingdom as a Visigothic nation, Atulf returned to the seductive idea of Roman rule. His marriage to Placida had given him visions of a world in which he controlled not just the ragtag Visigoths, but the empire itself. He hoped, says the historian Orosius, to seek for himself the glory of completely restoring and increasing the Roman name by the forces of the Goths, and to be held by posterity as the author of the restoration of Rome, since he had been unable to be its transformer. Attalus, the ex-emperor that Alaric had created and then stripped of his title, had been trailing around in the Visigothic army ever since. Now, Atulf again crowned him, setting him up once more as a rival emperor to Honorius. He would have done better to throw himself into building up the Visigoths. Honorius sent his right-hand general and magister militum, the Roman-born Constantius, against the new emperor. Constantius's army harassed the Visigoths, eventually capturing and beheading Attalus, and reducing Atulf's newborn kingdom to hunger and desperation. Resentment against Atulf began to simmer among his own people. In 415, one of his own countrymen murdered him and claimed the position of Visigoth king, only to be killed in turn 7 days later by another Visigoth war leader named Wallia. Wallia retrenched and sent word to Constantius that he was willing to make a deal. He would help the Western Roman army in Hispania to fight against a coalition of Germanic tribes who had made their way onto the peninsula, and he would send Honorius's sister Placida, the young hostage Aetius, now 19, and the other captives taken in Rome 5 years earlier back to Ravenna. In exchange, he wanted southwestern Gaul for the Visigoths. Honorius agreed to the treaty. After nearly 2 decades of wandering, the Visigoths finally had a homeland. The freed captives were soon put back into the service of the state. In 417, 2 years after her return to Ravenna, Placida was ordered by her brother to marry his general Constantius, the man who had driven her first husband Atulf into desperation and death. We do not know what she said. We do know that she obeyed him. And in 418, Honorius sent Aetius off in another hostage exchange. The Huns, still hovering on the distant edges of the known world, had agreed to make a temporary peace. The treaty demanded that both sides provide guarantees of goodwill by sending young men to live at the enemy court. Honorius offered the Huns Aetius, who had been home for only a short time. In return, the Huns sent a relative of the Hun war leader, Rua, Rua's nephew, a 12-year-old boy named Attila. Chapter 14. The Gupta Decline. Between 415 and 480, the Gupta Empire fades away, while Theravada Buddhism encourages the pursuit of individual enlightenment. When the Indian king Chandragupta II died in 415, he left behind him an empire of internal contradictions. It was modelled on the ancient glories of Asoka, but built on the armed conquests that Asoka had renounced. Sanskrit, the moribund language of nomadic invaders, had become its language of sophistication and education. It boasted a huge expanse, but in much of its territory the king ruled in name only. To complicate these internal contradictions, an outside threat arose. During the 39-year reign of his son and successor, Kumaragupta, the Hephthalites began to straggle down across the Kush Mountains. The Hephthalites were nomads from the wide steppes of Central Asia. The Indians called them Hunas, not because they were related to Huns in the West, but because the Indians used the general name Huns for all roaming nomadic groups north of the mountains. Author's note, many other sources refer to Hephthalites as White Huns, an equally inaccurate designation. Rather, the Hephthalites were most likely a branch of the Turkic peoples, Asian tribes that had long ago shared a common language, and began to spread out from their homeland in Central Asia during the 5th century. They had been fighting off and on with the Persians for 40 years already. The Armenian historian Faustos of Byzantium says that Shapur III fought against the great king of the Kushans, his term for the Hephthalites. Roman historians say that the Hephthalites were quite different from other nomadic invaders. They are ruled by one king, Procopius writes, and have a lawful government and deal in an upright and just way with each other and with their neighbours, just like Romans and Persians. Later Arab geographers, putting the history of the Persians into the context of their own holy books, record a genealogical tradition that the Hephthalites were descended from Shem, the son of Noah. But as far as the peoples of North India were concerned, they were simply Mleka, speakers of other tongues, barbarians in the classical sense. Kumaragupta drove them back, preserving the Gupta domain for the time being. Details of his other accomplishments are scarce, but one royal inscription boasts that his fame tasted the waters of the four oceans. Another inscription lays out the extent of his empire. By 436, it stretched from Mount Kailasa on the north to the forests on the slope of the Vindhya Mountains in the south, and was bordered by the oceans on the east and west. This was the largest area that the Guptas ever claimed for their own. Kumaragupta brought the empire to its peak. Legends of his reign reflect his real conquests. He was lord of the earth, with the valor of a lion and the strength of a tiger, the moon in the firmament of the Gupta dynasty. But the end of his reign seems to have been clouded by troubles. Inscriptions mention fighting in the region called Mekala, the land of the Vakataka in the western Deccan, the peoples that Chandragupta II had folded into the Gupta Empire by marriage. The new king of the Vakataka was Kumaragupta's own great-nephew, Narendrasena. He had come into his throne at just about the time that Kumaragupta was at the height of his power. But despite his great-uncle's fame, Narendrasena rebelled. The fighting seems to have taken place just as Kumaragupta was occupied with the Hephthalite invasions, and so Narendrasena was able to assert his independence. From this point on, the Gupta fortunes began to decline. A hostile invasion came next. It is not completely clear who the invaders were, but a stone pillar inscription says that they had great resources in men and money and threatened the Gupta kingdom with utter ruin. The fight against them, led by Kumaragupta's son and heir, Skandagupta, was long and difficult. At one point, Skandagupta was so bereft of men and supplies that he had to spend the night on the bare ground of a battlefield. Ultimately, the inscriptions tell us, the Guptas won the war against the invaders, but all was not well in the empire. Coins from the last years of Kumaragupta's reign are no longer made from silver or gold. Instead, they are made of copper, with a thin coating of silver concealing the inferior metal. The royal treasury had been thoroughly drained. When Kumaragupta died in 455, Skandagupta inherited his troubles as well. He beat the Heftalites off once again. He destroyed at its roots the pride of his enemies. His victory inscription reads, but the battles had taken a heavy toll. In the years after Skandagupta's accession, events become increasingly muddled, but a hazy picture of increasing disorder emerges. Poverty, quarrelling officials, rebellions of warlords and minor kings at the edges of the empire, constant war. Skandagupta fought for his entire reign, managing to keep the empire from disintegrating. Through most of the 460s, victory inscriptions continue to appear throughout the old Gupta territory. The last of these inscriptions dates to 467. After that, the evidence is confused. It seems likely that Skandagupta died in this year, and a war over the throne broke out, adding internal chaos to the chaos on the outside. First, Skandagupta's brother and then a nephew claimed the throne. Ultimately, the victor was a second nephew, Buddhagupta. He held on to the Gupta throne for 30 years, but he was the last Gupta king to rule over anything that resembled an empire. The Gupta attempt to hold together an empire of the mind had lasted only as long as no external threat approached. The Heftalite attacks during the reigns of Kumaragupta and Skandagupta were serious, but they were hardly civilization-ending, and not nearly as overwhelming as the Hun threat in the West. But turning to answer even a medium-sized crisis from the outside had strained the empire's cohesiveness to its limits. With the king's attention elsewhere, the states around the empire's edges, states that were receiving no real benefit from being part of the Gupta Empire, immediately seized on the opportunity to declare themselves once again free. In fact, it seems to have been the nature of Indian kingdoms to organize themselves as relatively small, independent entities with shifting borders. In the south, where the Gupta reach never extended, a multiplicity of dynasties claimed dominance over different parts of the subcontinent. Inscriptions and coins give us dozens of royal names, but no clear story emerges from the southern jostle. Towards the end of Buddhagupta's reign, there was no political power that seemed capable of uniting even a small part of the subcontinent. It was a low time for empires, but a flourishing time for religion. Buddhist monuments known as stupas spread across the country, many carved with scenes of worshippers. In the west of India, a series of temples and monasteries was carved into natural chambers, with pillars and prayer rooms, corridors and staircases, rock-hollowed great halls for the use of those who pursued knowledge rather than political power. They were modelled after wooden buildings, with stone rafters and ribs upholding the domed ceilings sculpted into the rock. The largest series of these temples, the 30 or so caves known as the Ajanta Caves, had already been under construction for the last 300 years, and work on them would continue for 300 more. 12 simpler caves had already been built in Ellora, barely 50 miles south. In this part of India, the Vakataka dominated, and the Vakataka king Harishena celebrated his victories by sponsoring the construction of at least two of these caves. Harishena, rising to the throne around 480, and overlapping the reign of Buddhagupta to the north, had acquired a brief empire of his own, but his fleeting kingdom would not outlast his death. The intersection between Harishena's victories and the cave temples was an aberration. Most of the caves were excavated simply to provide a place for worship, not to commemorate conquests. They had absolutely nothing to do with politics, and neither did the men who lived there. Among the cave temples were other networks of carved rooms, the viharas, monasteries complete with individual cells, common rooms, and refectories. Here the monks could devote themselves to the practice of their beliefs without distraction. They did not go into isolation. They lived in community themselves, and since they relied on lay people for clothing and food, items they could not acquire since they had renounced money, they also stayed in touch with the locals, but they took no part in the doings of the empire. By this time, Buddhism had branched into two major schools, the Theravada school and the Mahayana school. Both taught that all physical things were transient, and that only enlightenment, a state of mind reached through moral conduct and meditation, could reveal the world for what it is, an impermanent and unreal place. Theravada Buddhism, dominant in India, taught that reasoning, mindfulness, and concentration were of the greatest power in leading the mind to enlightenment. In slight contrast, Mahayana Buddhism, which tended to dominate the Chinese experience, stressed prayer, faith, divine revelation, emotion. With its greater emphasis on reasoning and thought, Theravada Buddhism placed a higher value on the monastic existence, which allowed the believer to put all of his energies into study and meditation. Certainly, Theravada Buddhism gave no help to an army officer or minor king who wanted to conquer an empire. It was diametrically opposed to earthly conquest, and rather than binding its adherents together under one flag, it encouraged them to live side by side while seeking individual enlightenment. Which is exactly what the landscape of India in the 5th century reflected. Perhaps Theravada Buddhism helped to produce the patchwork profile of India. Or perhaps the Indian patchwork made the country particularly suited to Theravada Buddhism. Either way, the result was the same. All across the Indian countryside, kingdoms existed side by side, each pursuing its own individual goals, none of them dominating the rest. Chapter 15. Northern Ambitions. Between 420 and 464, the Liu Song displaced the Jin, the Beiwei of the north brew magic potions, and the first state persecution of Buddhists begins. After its exile to the south, the dynasty of the Jin barely lasted a century. In an attempt to keep a strong core of aristocratic support, the emperors had begun to grant tax relief, exemption from military service, and other advantages to the descendants of the oldest families that had fled from Luoyang. As a result, the noble families of southern China had developed a keen interest in genealogical tables called jiapu, which would demonstrate their right to claim these privileges. These tables were becoming more and more complex as the aristocratic families took more and more pride in tracing real physical connections to the past, something that the ex-nomads of the north would never be able to do. Privilege led to power, and the power of the aristocrats finally brought an end to the Jin. The general Liu Yu, who had helped put down the pirates of the demon armies 15 years earlier, managed to ingratiate himself with the landowning families whose estates had been threatened by piracy and pillage. He gained their loyalty and their support, and in 420, Liu Yu forced the Jin emperor, Jin Gongdi, to abdicate. Like his predecessors, Liu Yu chose to make the abdication legal, rather than simply getting rid of the emperor. The myth of the mandate demanded that he gain the throne by virtue, not force. He sent a letter to Jin Gongdi, ordering the emperor to make an edict proclaiming that since Liu Yu had preserved the empire, it was only just that its rule be handed over to him. His army, standing behind him, gave Jin Gongdi a good reason to comply. A ceremony in a building erected specifically for this purpose sealed the transfer of power, and Jin Gongdi retired into private life. Now the general became emperor under the name Song Wu Di, founder of a new dynasty. The Liu Song. Author's note. The Liu Song, also transliterated as plain Song and as Sung, ruled in the southeast from 420 to 479. The Jin had ended. Now the two strongest powers in China were the Liu Song of the south and the Beiwei, still one among several states to the north. 2 years after his accession, Song Wu Di removed the living memory of the previous dynasty. He ordered one of the court officials to poison Jin Gongdi, now in his late 30s and living peacefully in the capital city. The official, still loyal to the Jin family, wavered in indecision for some time, finally deciding that the choice lay between killing the man he still thought of as the rightful king of his country and being put to death by Song Wu Di for failing his commission. He drank the poison himself. Song Wu Di sent a second official with another dose of poison. When the deposed Jin Gongdi greeted him at the door, he saw at once what was happening. But he refused to be poisoned, something that would have allowed Song Wu Di to pretend that Jin Gongdi's death was natural. Instead, the official smothered him, which allowed Song Wu Di to carry on the pretense almost as well. According to tradition, he met with his officials the next day to receive news of the death and wept copiously. Then he gave the murdered king a glorious royal funeral, with hundreds of mourners lamenting around the tomb. Wrapped in the mantle of legitimacy, Song Wu Di now reigned as unquestioned emperor of the traditional Chinese realm. But he had been in his late 50s when he took power, and the year after he did away with Jin Gongdi, he took to his bed with his last illness. He passed his throne to his 19-year-old son, Shao, a wild teenager who ruled for a little over a year, before the throne was taken by Song Wudi's second son, Shao's older half-brother, Song Wendi. Song Wendi became king in 424 and held on to power for 29 years, bringing the new dynasty to a brief high point. Known as the Reign of Yuan Jia, these 29 years combined successful war, mostly against the nomadic Xiong Nu tribes. Song Wendi led a three-year campaign that drove them to the west, and competent administration. In 439, the emperor established four Confucian colleges, each staffed by distinguished Confucian scholars, for the purpose of training the young men of his empire in the principles and precepts of Confucian literature, something that made them better officials and bureaucrats. Soon the Liu Song kingdom in the south had a northern counterpart. In 440, the Bei Wei king, Wei Taiwu, managed to conquer the remaining northern states to unify the north under his rule. The Bei Wei, which had existed as a kingdom since 386, would rule as a northern empire for the next century. Now the split between north and south was complete. The Bei Wei, like the other northern kingdoms, was made up of people who had not long before been nomadic. Slowly, over the last century, they had begun to settle under a single king, to centralize, to develop laws and regular armies and diplomats. By the time the Bei Wei unified the north, the kingdom had already adopted many of the traditions and ways of the south. The king, Wei Taiwu, had a Chinese advisor, Gui Hao, who brought Chinese administration and Chinese law into the king's court and helped him to implement it. In their own eyes, the Bei Wei were mostly Chinese. But Wei Taiwu retained one bit of the nomadic tradition. Like a war leader, he kept a harsh and autocratic hand on his people. He organized his kingdom into a strict hierarchy. The countryside was divided into communes, or dang, each one with its own administrator. Each dang was divided into five villages, li, with a leader in each village reporting to the clan administrator. Each li was made up of five lin, or neighborhoods. Each lin consisted of five families. To this tight structure, Wei Taiwu added something that was new in the north, a state religion. He had been deeply influenced by his Chinese minister, Gui Hao, who followed a weird and idiosyncratic version of Taoism. Classic Taoism taught non-action, withdrawal from the world of strife and politics in order to focus on personal enlightenment. The mythical seven sages of the Bamboo Grove, a group of Taoist philosophers who were said to have lived in the previous century, were the model for perfect Taoist detachment. They revered and exalted the void and non-action, drank wine to excess, and disregarded the affairs of this world, which seemed to them like duckweed. Originally, Taoism had not paid much attention to the afterlife. Promises of immortality were not part of its philosophy. But some decades earlier, a Chinese philosopher named Ge Hong had begun to teach a new kind of Taoism. This Taoism encouraged its followers to seek enlightenment through magical elixirs that would lift the drinker to a higher spiritual level and, as a side effect, bring eternal youth. Ge Hong claimed that his family had received three texts from a divine being, the Scriptures of the Elixirs, or Taiping texts, with instructions on how to create these magical potions. What earlier Taoists had achieved through philosophy, 5th-century Taoists could achieve with chemical aids. Ge Hong, the Timothy Leary of Chinese Taoism, had turned Taoism into something more like a cult than a philosophy. In 415, one of the chief teachers of this new kind of Taoism, Gao Qianji, left the mountain where he had been living as a hermit and came into the Bei Wei, ending up at Wei Taiwu's court. Wei Taiwu, already enamored with this new Taoism, welcomed him and built him a temple, putting him and his disciples up at taxpayers' expense. In 442, Gao Qianji gave the emperor a book of charms. After this, the historian C.P. Fitzgerald writes, every emperor of the Wei dynasty used to proceed to the Taoist temple at his accession and obtain a charm book. Taoism had become something completely new, a state religion that lent its magical powers to support the emperors and their claim to power. Wei Taiwu's enthusiasm for his new religion led him to defend it with the sword. In 446, Wei Taiwu was forced to put down a rebellion led by a guerrilla fighter who had stored weapons in Buddhist temples. Wei Taiwu was convinced that Buddhist priests had been part of the conspiracy to overthrow his magically confirmed reign. He began by outlawing the religion. "I am determined to destroy every trace of Buddhism from my kingdom," he announced in an official edict declaring Buddhism anathema. "I have been appointed by heaven to establish the right and to sweep away what is false." He then ordered his men to slaughter all of the Buddhist monks in the empire, starting in the capital, Chang'an. The killings began. They were only mitigated in part by Wei Taiwu's son, the crown prince Huang. Huang was himself a Buddhist, and when he discovered that his father was about to issue the edict, he sent secret messages to all of the Buddhist priests he could reach, warning them to flee. Many of them did, but not all. Many more were captured and put to death, and the Buddhist temples across the entire Beiwei Empire were reduced to rubble. Once he had put down the rebellion and killed the alleged conspirators, Wei Taiwu suggested to Song Wendi of the Liu Song that the two Chinese empires make a permanent peace, sealed with a marriage alliance. In his own eyes, his empire was just as Chinese as the South. Song Wendi not only disagreed, but was so insulted by the barbarian attempt to behave like an equal that he invaded the Beiwei territory twice. The invasions damaged his own army and accomplished nothing, and despite its indignation of the barbarian presumption and its own claims to be a legitimate royal family, the Song was weakening while the Beiwei prospered.
Song Wendi's younger son, Song Zhaowu, became emperor in 454 and ruled for 10 years. Contemporary chroniclers pointed to his reign as a time when the mandate began to fade. Song Zhaowu was frivolous and pleasure-centered.
He preferred hunting to state business, and instead of addressing his officials and nobles of the court by their proper titles, something in which they placed great stock, he gave them undignified nicknames. So shallow and worthless was he that when he died, 10 years after his accession, his son and heir showed no grief upon hearing the news. His ministers were shocked. "The dynasty will not be long before it perishes," they cried.
Chapter 16. The Huns. Between 423 and 450, the Vandals build a pirate kingdom in North Africa, and the Bishop of Rome becomes the Pope, while Aetius takes control of the Western Empire and the Huns approach its borders. While the Eastern Roman Empire hosted theological councils, the Western Empire struggled for survival. Britannia had been abandoned. Under Wallia and his successor, the Visigoths prospered in southwestern Gaul, allies of Rome but a sovereign state in their own right, and despite the efforts of a combined Roman and Visigothic army, the Vandals had managed to take over much of Hispania, forming their own kingdom there and shaking off all Roman attempts to retake the former province. The Western Emperor Honorius died in 423. After a scuffle for power that occupied the best part of a year, his nephew Valentinian III, 6 years old, son of Honorius's sister Placida and her second husband, the general Constantius, was crowned as emperor. Placida, the little boy's regent, was soon forced to appoint as Magister Militum the Roman soldier Aetius, the hostage who had been sent first to the Visigoths and then to the Huns. Aetius had been returned by the Huns some time earlier, although we have no record of exactly when. But in his years with the Huns, he had developed a friendship with his hosts. After Honorius's death, Aetius, 25 years old, hardened by exile and accustomed to tricky situations, made it clear to Placida that his Hun friends would descend on Ravenna unless he was given the highest military post in the West. Placida gave him both the title and the authority that went with it. Meanwhile, another part of the Western Empire disappeared. In 429, the king of the Vandals in Hispania, Gaiseric, built a fleet of ships and sailed across the mouth of the Mediterranean Sea. He then began to march along the North African coast, conquering his way through Roman provinces and independent African kingdoms alike. By 430, he had reached the Roman city of Hippo Regius. His army laid siege to it while the elderly Bishop Augustine lay inside, suffering from his final illness. The siege dragged on for 18 months. The man who had written of the ultimate triumph of the kingdom of God died, with Vandals still surrounding his city and no hope of relief. When Hippo fell, Gaiseric marched on to Carthage. It was defeated and overrun in 431. Gaiseric lined up the Roman soldiers who had defended it, forced them to swear an oath that they would never again fight against a Vandal army, and then let them go. North Africa was lost to Rome. Before long, Gaiseric decided to concentrate his energies on his North African holdings. He abandoned Hispania and ruled as a North African pirate king, his headquarters at Carthage, a master of a powerful Vandal kingdom that had sprung up as quickly as a mushroom. Aetius, Magister Militum and now the most powerful man in the Western Empire, made no effort to fight for the Roman territories across the Mediterranean. He sent the nominal emperor Valentinian III off to visit Constantinople, where Valentinian, now 19, married his co-emperor's daughter, creating a blood alliance between the two halves of the empire. While the emperor was away, Aetius went to war in Gaul. North Africa was now lost, the Visigoths were firmly established in southwestern Gaul, and Hispania was too far to recapture. Parts of it now fell into the hands of another Germanic tribe, the Suevi, and the Visigoths began to push their way into the land vacated by the Vandals. But Aetius had no intention of losing the land on his northwestern frontier as well. He had already put down a rebellion of the Germanic Franks, who lived within the Roman borders as federati. Now he mustered his army and marched against the Burgundians, yet another Germanic tribe who had settled in the Rhine Valley as federati. Their king, Gundahar, had established his capital at Borbotomagus, later the city of Worms, and was showing worrying tendencies towards independence. Aetius hired Hun mercenaries to fight with him against the Germanic upstarts. In a brutal battle in 437, the Romans and Huns together destroyed Borbotomagus, crushed the Burgundians, and killed Gundahar. The slaughter survived in the tales of the Germanic tribes, and came down into the Nibelungenlied, the Song of the Nibelung. The Burgundian king Gundahar, whose name is rendered Gunther, welcomes the dragon slayer Siegfried to his court at the epic's beginning, and at the end travels to the land of the Huns and is murdered by treachery. Aetius had now used the Huns for years to establish his own power, but the Huns were not tame mercenaries, and Aetius was about to find himself the loser in his dangerous game. Up until this point, the Huns had not launched any sort of sustained assault on the Romans. Stories of their unearthly ferocity and strength had become a staple of Roman history. "They made their foes flee in horror," says Jordanes, "because they had, if I may call it so, a sort of shapeless lump, not a head, with a pinhole rather than eyes." But the Huns were not yet a great threat to the empire. Hun raids, when they troubled the borders, were damaging and scary, but the Huns always withdrew. The Huns had not been able to sustain an attack, because they had never been a single unified force. Like the Germanic barbarians, they were a coalition of tribes with no particular loyalty to each other. "They are not subject to the authority of any king," Ammianus Marcellinus writes, "but break through any obstacle in their path under the improvised command of their chief men. They did not plant or tend crops. Instead, they drove cows, goats, and sheep in herds across the countryside, which meant that it took a lot of pasture to feed a group of Huns. So they had remained in small nomadic knots, easier to support, economically more stable than a massive monolithic force. They had no strategy for taking over the world. They were simply trying to survive." But even while Aetius was hiring those independent bands of Huns to fight for him, Hun society was changing. Over the preceding decades, they had made their way from the bare foraging ground east of the Black Sea into the relatively rich and cultivated land of the Goths, land that allowed at least the possibility of feeding themselves in a new way and coalescing into a much larger group. Sometime around 432, the warrior chief Rua, uncle of the young hostage Attila, who had been returned to his own tribe after spending some years at Ravenna, had managed to extend his power over Hun tribes unrelated to his own. By 434, Attila and his brother Bleda had succeeded their uncle as joint chiefs over an expanding Hun coalition. 6 years later, Attila and Bleda led their combined Hun army in an attack on a Roman fort on the Danube. They continued to rampage up and down the Roman side of the river, flattening forts and towns, before they withdrew in 441 and agreed to negotiate a truce. For 2 years, the Huns kept the truce. Then, in 443, they headed for Constantinople with battering rams and siege towers.
Theodosius II, evaluating the approaching force and deciding that it would be prudent to settle rather than fight, paid them off and agreed to a crippling yearly tribute. Once again, the Huns retreated, and another temporary silence descended over them. Not long after the retreat from Constantinople, Attila killed his brother Bleda and proclaimed himself the single unopposed king of his people. In the breathing space provided by their truces with the Eastern and Western empires, the Huns were mutating from a loose coalition into a ruthless, conquering horde. The Huns, wrote the exiled Bishop Nestorius in his lengthy defense of his own beliefs, a book that touches only briefly on outside events, had been divided into peoples and into kingdoms, and were only robbers who used not to do much wrong except through rapacity and speed. But now they were a kingdom, very strong, so that they surpassed in their greatness all the forces of the Romans. With the Huns on their very doorstep, the emperors of Eastern and Western Rome occupied themselves with a quarrel over theological power. In 444, the new bishop of Rome, Leo I, wrote an official letter to the bishop of Thessalonica in the province of Illyricum, informing him in no uncertain terms that the bishop of Rome, as the heir of Peter, was the only churchman with the authority to make final decisions for the entire Christian church. The bishop of Thessalonica had, in Leo's view, overstepped himself by bringing another bishop up before the civil court in Illyricum. No matter what the reason for this arraignment, Leo scolded, only Rome had the right to exert authority over other bishops. Even if he had committed some grave and intolerable misdemeanor, you should have waited for our opinion, so as to arrive at no decision by yourself until you knew our pleasure. Though all priests have a common dignity, yet they have not uniform rank. Inasmuch as even among the blessed apostles, notwithstanding the similarity of their honorable estate, there was a certain distinction of power, and while the election of them all was equal, yet it was given to one to take the lead of the rest. From which model has arisen a distinction between bishops also. The care of the universal church should converge towards Peter's one seat, and nothing anywhere should be separated from its head. Leo did not depend only on this letter to establish his authority. He appealed to the throne, and in 445, Valentinian III, still dominated politically by his magister militum, Aetius, agreed to make a formal official decree that recognized the Bishop of Rome as the official head of the entire Christian Church. Leo the Great, the Bishop of Rome, had become the first pope. His claim to imperially sanctioned power infuriated the Bishop of Alexandria. The bishops of Rome and Alexandria had been allies at the 431 Council in Ephesus, but since then, the power of Alexandria had grown. Now the Bishop of Rome saw the current Bishop of Alexandria, Dioscorus, as his primary competition both for theological power and for the ear of the emperor. Dioscorus was just as suspicious of Leo the Great, and he tried to flex some theological muscle in return. Although both men were monophysites, one nature supporters, author's note, monophysitism held that Christ's divine and human natures were mystically united into an indivisible whole. See chapter 12. Dioscorus's version of monophysitism was more extreme than Leo's. He insisted that the two natures of Christ became a single divine nature at the incarnation, an interpretation that almost veered back over into heresy again, since it tended to remove Christ's humanity from view. In 449, Dioscorus called a hasty church council in Ephesus and talked the bishops who were able to arrive on short notice into signing documents that affirmed his version of monophysitism as orthodox. According to later accounts, some of the bishops signed blank papers. The theological content was filled in later, while others who didn't sign simply found that their names mysteriously had appeared at the bottom of pro-monophysite statements. All of this earned the council the title robber council, or the latrocinium, a term condemning the council as illegitimate. Author's note, the same term was later used of Vatican II by some Catholics. Dioscorus then wrapped up this performance by declaring the Bishop of Constantinople a heretic and by excommunicating the absent Bishop of Rome, a clear attempt to usurp the authority of Rome by transferring it to Alexandria. Leo I responded by excommunicating everyone who had been at the council. Since they had all now excommunicated each other, The struggle for theological power appeared temporarily to be at an impasse, and at the moment, while the bishops were declaring each other to be anathema, two of Attila's lieutenants appeared in Constantinople, carrying a threat from their king. The lieutenants were a mixed pair. One was a Hun, the other a Roman-born man of Germanic blood named Orestes. Their threat was couched in diplomatic terms. Attila accused the Eastern Empire of breaking the terms of its truce with him, and demanded that ambassadors, of the highest rank, be sent to meet him at Sardica to resolve the issue. Theodosius II and his advisers, meeting hastily together, organized a small party of ambassadors to travel back to Attila's headquarters. One member of the party, the historian Priscus, later wrote of the Roman journey into Hun-occupied territory. Passing the sacked city of Nisus, where Constantine the Great was born, they saw that it had been reduced to heaps of stones and rubble. So many bones of the dead city's defenders littered the ground that the party was unable to find a clear space to camp for the night. On the journey, the Eastern Roman embassy found its paths intersecting with an embassy from Ravenna, also hoping to negotiate a peace with Attila. Together, the representatives of both halves of the empire finally arrived at Attila's headquarters on the other side of the Danube, a village he had built to be his temporary capital. Priscus was stunned by the workmanship. It was, he says, more like a great city than a village, built of wooden walls made of smooth, shining boards. Dining halls of large extent and porticos planned with great beauty, while the courtyard was bounded by so vast a circuit that its very size showed it was the royal palace. The negotiations were difficult. Attila did not intend to come to an easy peace. In the end, the Western Roman party sent by Aetius saved the day. Aetius, who knew the Huns better than anyone else, had sent terms that Attila was willing to accept. By the time the two embassies departed, Attila had agreed to refrain from attacking either the Eastern or Western Roman kingdom. Into this temporary peace, a new complication suddenly intruded itself. Down in Rome, the Emperor Valentinian's sister Honoria had been living in the royal court for most of her life. In 449, she was 31, and her life was growing ever more dull. She was unmarried, and although she had great privilege as the emperor's sister, his daughters were growing up and overshadowing her. The one bright spot in her life was her steward, Eugenius, who became her lover. But late in 449, her brother discovered the affair. To him, it seemed an act of treason. If Honoria married Eugenius, the pair could easily become emperor and empress, since Valentinian had no male heir. He arrested Eugenius, put him to death, and ordered his sister to marry a Roman senator named Herculanus, an older man who had a bone-deep loyalty to the emperor and could be depended upon to resist if his wife attempted to draw him into ambitious or revolutionary schemes. Honoria was horrified, and so she sent one of her servants on the dangerous journey to Attila's camp, along with money, a ring, and a promise. If Attila would come and rescue her, she would marry him. A shameful thing indeed, sniffs Jordanes, to get license for her passion at the cost of the public good. But Honoria wasn't indulging her passion for Attila, who, despite his undoubted charisma, was 12 years her senior, and universally described as short, squat, small-eyed, and large-nosed. She had seen a way out of her grey and pointless life. If she were to marry Attila, he could become emperor of Rome, and she would be empress, and even if he failed to overcome her brother, she would still become queen of the Huns. Attila at once accepted the offer. He sent a message not to Valentinian, but to Theodosius II, the senior and more powerful of the two emperors, demanding not only Honoria for his wife, but also half of the Western Roman territory as her dowry. And Theodosius wrote at once to Valentinian, suggesting that he do as Attila demanded in order to avoid an invasion of the Huns. Valentinian was apoplectic, both at his sister's plan and at Theodosius's suggestion. He tortured and beheaded the servant who had carried Honoria's message, and threatened violence to his sister as well. But his mother Placida, who had herself been married to the barbarian Atulf, interceded and protected the princess. He also refused flatly to agree to Attila's demands. It was at this delicate moment that Theodosius II, out riding — he was passionately fond of tsukan, an early form of polo, and had laid out a polo ground in Constantinople — fell from his horse and died. Like Valentinian II, he left no male heir. The most powerful personality in the East was his sister Pulcheria, his co-ruler and empress. Pulcheria chose a husband to help her remain empress, the soldier Marcian, who had been at Carthage when Gaiseric took it from the Romans 18 years earlier. After swearing the required oath not to fight the Vandals anymore, Marcian had been set free and had spent the next 2 decades rising through the ranks of the army. He had to agree, as a condition of the marriage, to maintain Pulcheria's virginity, which he did. She was, in any case, 51. The first act as rulers of the West was to defy Attila, refusing to pay him the bribes that Theodosius had been shelling out to keep the Huns from attacking Constantinople. It was a gamble. Attila might turn and attack, but on the other hand, he had just been given the perfect excuse for invading Valentinian's domain instead. The gamble succeeded. Attila assembled his army. The frightened residents of the Western Empire insisted that he had 500,000 men at his command, and began to march west. Chapter 17. Attila. Between 450 and 455, Attila the Hun approaches Rome. Pope Leo the Great negotiates a political peace, and the Huns lose their chance at nationhood. Rather than marching straight across the difficult Alps directly towards Ravenna, Attila led his army towards Gaul. By April, he had reached the city of Metz, right in the center of the former Roman province, and captured it for his own. "They came to the town of Metz on Easter Eve," writes Gregory of Tours, "burned the town to the ground, slaughtered the populace with the sharp edge of their swords, and killed the priests of the Lord in front of their holy altars." His territory now stretched almost from the Black Sea to the north of Italy, threatening both Roman capitals. The general Aetius, who for so long had controlled the affairs of the Western Empire, put together a coalition against him. The Western Roman army was joined by the Visigoths of Hispania and southwestern Gaul under their king, Theodoric I, and Aetius also had a new ally, the tribe of the Salians. The Salians were Franks, the strongest of the tribes who settled into northern Gaul as federati. Now the chief of the Salians led the warriors of the entire Frankish coalition into the Roman camp to help fight against the Huns. He was one of the earliest long-haired kings of the Franks. The Salian chiefs wore their hair long to distinguish them from the ordinary Franks, to demonstrate their greater power. The name of this chief is unknown, but later chroniclers would call him Merovich. Aetius now had Visigoths, Franks, and Burgundians, the Germanic tribe in the Rhine Valley now in full submission to Rome, in his camp. The joint army of former barbarians and Roman soldiers marched towards the western Roman city of Orléans. In June of 451, they met the Huns in battle at Chalons-sur-Marne, halfway between Orléans and the Hun-occupied town of Metz. Jordanes says that while the Huns put Attila and his strongest warriors in the center of their line, with the weaker and less reliable allies on each wing, Aetius and his Romans fought on one wing, and Theodoric I and the Visigoths on the other, with the troops in whose loyalty they had little confidence in the middle, so that they could not easily flee in the midst of battle. The strategy succeeded. The wings of the Hun attack disintegrated, and Attila was forced to retreat with his corps of warriors back across the Rhine. Gaul had been saved in an expensive victory. Over 150,000 soldiers fell in the battle. The chronicler Hydatius claims that 300,000 men died. The slaughter was so great, says Jordanes, that a brook flowing through the battlefield was swollen and turned into a torrent by the increase of blood. Theodoric I of the Visigoths had fallen in battle. His son Thorismund led the diminished Visigoths back to Toulouse kingless. The Franks limped home, their numbers slashed. Attila, on the other side of the Rhine, kept track of the disbanding of the coalition. When the allies were safely away, he made a second attack, this one on Italy itself. The attack began in early 452, and the north of Italy quickly fell to the Huns. Attila's army destroyed the city of Aquileia, sacked Milan and Ticinum, and laid waste to the countryside. Aetius's reduced army was not strong enough to meet him in full battle again. Instead, the Romans were forced to harass the Huns in small sorties, doing their best to slow the Hun advance. When Valentinian III left Ravenna with his court and went south to Rome for safety, it became clear that neither the emperor nor the Magister Militum had any chance of halting the Hun advance. So Leo the Great, Bishop of Rome and the first Pope of the Christian Church, took matters into his own hands. He travelled north to intercede with the King of the Huns on his own. Attila agreed to see him, and the two men met at the Po River. Afterwards, Leo never wrote or spoke of what had passed between them, but when the audience had ended, Attila had agreed to a peace. To the terrified Romans, and perhaps to Aetius as well, Leo's success must have seemed like a magic spell. The historian Prosper of Aquitaine thought that Attila was overwhelmed by Leo's holiness. Paul the deacon insisted that a huge supernatural warrior with a drawn sword, sort of a cross between Mars and St. Peter, stood beside Leo and terrified Attila into a truce. But hints of different motivations can be woven together into a less dramatic interpretation. For one thing, the Huns had lost as many warriors as their opponents. Attila's remaining army could ravage northern Italian towns, but a siege of Rome was probably out of his power. For another, the Huns were already fairly well loaded down with loot and were no longer as dead set on collecting further riches. And for a third, they were becoming very anxious to leave Italy. The summer heat had aggravated an episode of plague, and this heaven-sent disaster was decimating their already thinned ranks. Leo's approach gave Attila the chance to retreat with his dignity intact. He left Italy still breathing fire, insisting that he would come storming back to the west if Valentinian III didn't send him Honoria, seeming to regret the peace and vexed at the cessation of war, Jordanes writes. Leo returned to Rome haloed with victory. For the first time in history, a bishop had taken on the emperor's job. Valentinian's decree, the six-year-old imperial pronouncement that made Leo head of the entire Christian church, had given the Pope an extra dimension of power. He was the spiritual head of the church, but the spirit of the church could not survive if its adherents were wiped out. As spiritual leader, he could also claim the right to guarantee the church's physical survival. Attila would never return to Italy. Back in his headquarters across the Danube, recovering his strength and rebuilding his army, he decided to marry. His choice was Ildiko, the daughter of a Gothic chief. She was reportedly young and very beautiful, but the marriage also gave him a closer tie with the Gothic allies he needed to rebuild his weakened army. Attila was not averse to having more than one wife, but he had likely given up hope of gaining the title of Western Roman Emperor by way of marriage with Honoria. If he wanted Rome, he was going to have to fight for it. He celebrated the wedding with an enormous feast, at which he gave himself up to excessive joy. As Jordanes puts it, he probably drank an enormous amount before passing out in the bridal chamber. As he lay on his back, Jordanes writes, repeating the lost account of the historian Priscus, heavy with wine and sleep, a rush of superfluous blood, which would ordinarily have flowed from his nose, streamed in deadly course down his throat and killed him. When his attendants broke down the doors of his rooms, late the next morning, they found Attila dead in his bed, and his bride weeping and covered with his blood. His officers buried him late at night, filling the grave with treasure, and then, like Alaric's followers decades earlier, executing the gravediggers so that his burial place could never be found. Attila's sons tried to pick up his mantle, but with their leader dead, the Huns began to disintegrate. Like the Visigoths before Alaric, the Huns before Attila were not a nation. They were barely even a people. They were still simply a collection of tribes with a distant past in common and a charismatic leader. Alaric had turned his followers into Visigoths. Attila had united his tribes into a single army of Huns. But when the ambition of a single leader was the driving force behind the emergence of a new people, the death of the leader could mean the death of a newborn national identity. The Visigoths, perhaps through long association with the Romans, had picked up enough trappings of administration and bureaucracy to hold their confederation together until a new king emerged. The Huns were not so lucky. By 455, they had been thoroughly defeated. Driven back from the Roman borders, they scattered. Their chance to become a nation had passed. Chapter 18. Orthodoxy. Between 451 and 454, both the Eastern Roman Emperor and the Persian Emperor tried to control belief. The eastern half of the empire had not been unconcerned with the affairs in the western half. Attila's invasion, the rising power of Vandal and Visigothic kingdoms, the rapid turnover in emperors, all of these had registered on the consciousness of the Eastern Roman court. Registered, but not dominated. The Roman court at Constantinople was preoccupied with its own difficulties. Nothing reveals the death of the common Roman cause like the relative prosperity and peace of the Eastern Roman Empire during the West's struggle for survival. In fact, while Aetius and his allies were fighting desperately against the Huns in Gaul, the Eastern Roman Emperor Marcian was presiding over a church council. He had called this council to tackle, once again, the vexed problem of how Christ's two natures, the human and the divine, related to each other. The bishops of Rome and Alexandria were still excommunicated, the bishop of Constantinople had been declared a heretic, and Marcian hoped to straighten the situation out. The desire was complicated by Marcian's tendency to agree with the bishop of Rome's theology. He wanted to support the power of the bishops in his own part of the empire, but Leo's expression of the relationship between the two natures was much more attractive to him. In Christ, Leo had written, the human and divine natures remain distinct, not divided in essence, but both natures retain their own proper character without loss. For each form does what is proper to it with the cooperation of the other, that is, the Word performing what appertains to the Word, and the flesh carrying out what appertains to the flesh. It was this formulation that Marcian found closest to his own conviction, and little wonder. Leo had neatly encapsulated the double identity that lay at the core of the empire's existence. It was the same capacity to hold two things together in one that had attracted Constantine back at the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. But Marcian had to promote Leo's doctrine without admitting Leo's claim to ultimate spiritual power, something the emperor wanted to keep for his own city. Constantinople had to remain equal to Rome, so when he called the church council in 451, he refused to hold it in Italy as Leo suggested. He announced that instead it would be at the city of Chalcedon, right across the water from Constantinople. This was a little too far for Leo to come, particularly since he did not wish to leave the Church of Rome leaderless during a Hun invasion.